Getting on board the phone line right now and welcoming in, my gosh, he is a media maven today. Let's see, start of the day, I believe, with our friend Mike Violet. We'll be on the Jab down in Portland this afternoon, and we are the meat in his radio sandwich, Chad Finn joining us.
That's exactly, Rich. You are the meat in the sandwich, as I've always said.
You were up early this morning with Mike.
Yeah, that one's a little too early for me. You can hear me trying to get my bearings in that one for the first 5 minutes of it. But he does most of the talking, and then I eventually wake up.
Mike Violent does most of the talk. Well, color me shocked.
Yeah, we don't talk politics either. So
that's good. That's a relief. My goodness gracious. Well, so much going on here. Where to begin? Let's start with the WBC. Have you been following that at all?
Yeah. I really wasn't too much, but I was down in Fort Myers last week, and it was really cool to see how into it the players were. And for the first time, from what I gather, the U.S. players are feeling that way too. You know, Mookie and Trout playing really kind of amplified this, where the best guys, if they're not there this year, I bet you see them in the future. And you really have the A-list team, A-list roster. They're pretty close now. But players from other countries were just super into it. The Red Sox did a course that they did a little presentation in the clubhouse before Devers and Kike and guys like that left to join their respective teams. And they all had to talk about the country they were from and put together a little pasteboard presentation. And it was just, you could tell it really mattered to a lot of guys. And Cora's been a part of it for a long time. He was on the 96 Puerto Rico team. And it's something that has really mattered to the world for a good stretch now, and it's finally coming around to being important here.
So in your time down there in Fort Myers, what was the mood of the team, and who's stepping into the leadership roles of the team with some prominent departures?
Well, it's a really good group that they've brought in. That was cool to see. Kenley Jansen is just a gregarious personality, always, you're in the locker room, a lot of guys have their chair facing that locker, you know, on their phones or whatever. Jansen's a guy who is always facing outward, always talking to people. Corey Kluber is a much quieter guy, but he's the same way, just really kind of even keel, but friendly. Everybody knows Justin Turner from his time with the Dodgers, a really well-respected personality around the league. Adam Duvall is a super guy. So I don't know if it's by design. I don't know how much stock Chaim Bloom puts into that, into chemistry or culture, but it is noticeable that the people that they've brought into this team this year all seem like people you'd want to be around and spend a season with. And we'll see how good they are in the field, but I think they're going to have a good mix in terms of likable players.
Now, 2 years ago, right around this time, 2 years ago, you told us when other people were poo-pooing the team, scoffing at their chances, you told us and others that you thought they would be a pleasant surprise, and they turned out to have a terrific year, getting all the way to the American League Championship Series. Do you see any of those signs this year?
I don't even remember saying that 2 years ago, so I'm going to take a victory lap for something I don't even remember, but that kind of fits my usual approach. But I think they're going to be better than people think. If you look at, like, you know, I hate all the gambling talk, but if you look at, like, their over-unders are around 78 wins, they're better than that. I think they're going to be right on the fringe of the wild card race. Obviously, they need a lot to go right. They need Sale to be Sale. He's looked fantastic. He's in a great mood. You know, it could be not surly, because he was always a great guy to talk to about his teammates. But this time around, this spring, he's just been in a fantastic mood. And I take that as an indicator that he feels great for the first time in a long time. You need Yoshida to be really good and be a run producer. It's how they're looking at him. I think he will be. I mean, the guy in batting practice is a show. And they may really have something here. You need some of the young guys to emerge. You need Garrett Whitlock to be a quality starter and stay healthy this year. You need Bayo to stay healthy and live up to some of his vast abilities. So there's a lot you're asking, but a lot of it is also realistic. And if 75% of what they need to go right goes right, that could be pretty good.
Well, and I just look at the schedule, too, and the fact that they won't be playing pretty tough American League East rivals 19 times apiece.
Yeah, plus they've got Raimel Tapia, who hit like 850 against the Red Sox last couple of years, tore him up with the Blue Jays. So addition by subtraction there. They don't have to face the modern-day Stan Musial because he's with them and may even make the team. But, yeah, I like the way the schedule breaks down now. I'm not an interleague play guy, and I never will be. I think it's detracted from baseball in a lot of ways. And there's a couple rivalries. Yankees, the Subway Series is always pretty fun, but the Red Sox don't really have a natural rival. So I kind of like the way the schedule breaks down. At least we are getting a real balance across the American League now, and you're going to see Mike Trout more than you have been Ohtani and guys like that than you have the past couple of years.
What has the response been to the book so far?
Everybody hates it, and I hear they're having book burnings all over the country.
Wow!
But it's big in Florida, shockingly. No, great. Yeah, it's been really, really fulfilling. One of the fun things about it, it's called The Boston Globe Story of the Red Sox, and it's basically a collection of, as we talked about before, all the Globe's baseball writing through the Red Sox history, because the Globe's actually like 30 years older than the Red Sox are, so they covered them from the beginning and thoroughly from the beginning. And one of the fun things has been people asking me, is this in there? Is that in there? And specific stories they remember. And a lot of the time they are. Somebody asked me right when I announced that the book was coming out, right before the pub date, because the publisher kind of kept it under wraps for a little while, but I announced it was coming out and what it was, and somebody immediately emailed me and said, is Shaughnessy's Dwight Evans column from 1990 in there? And I was like, yeah, actually it is. When they let him go, and Dan wrote that they did him wrong. There's a really thoughtful piece on Dewey, and I really liked it as I was putting the book together, so I made sure to include it. And it's always nice when I can say that somebody asked me if something's in there, and I can say yes.
My Amazon tells me it should be arriving at my home in the next day or two, so I'm looking forward to it. Is there anything in there? One of the stranger moments in Red Sox history was the Buddy LaRue coup on the night they were honoring Tony Conigliaro.
Where did you come up with that one? Nobody's ever asked me about Buddy LaRue.
Because I just think that encapsulated a time in Red Sox history when things just weren't going great. Management was a mess. And on the night they were going to honor one of the favorite players to ever come out of the state of Massachusetts, Buddy tried to take over ownership of the team. And I remember being some pretty good columns at the time about that.
Yeah, that is in there. It's some sad stuff with Tony C around that time, too. He had a stroke and, died in his 40s. And, last several years of his life weren't great. And so he's part of that story, too. But, it's funny because in the story that's in the book there, I can't remember who wrote it. And it was before Nick Cafardo's time. Might have been Larry Whiteside. But they had two press conferences, one with Buddy LaRue and then one with Haywood Sullivan afterwards, saying, yeah, we're still running this. We're still in charge. And it was almost like the team had two ownership groups for a couple of days until it all got sorted out. But it was just chaos. The Harrington Trust after Tommy Aki died in 1976, and Harrington Trust, there was just all kinds of weirdness that went on, especially in the early 80s when Haywood Sullivan ran the team and, ran off Fisk and Fred Lynn and Burleson and my guy Butch Hobson. Those are some of the years where I reread those stories and just got frustrated all over again with some of the decisions they made back then.
Chad Finn with us here on Downtown. The book is called The Red Sox, The Story of the Red Sox. And Chad edits it and writes some of the pieces that connect it all together. And if you are a Red Sox fan, you got to get it. Let's talk a little Patriots. What do you think of the recent moves? I like Juju Smith-Schuster. That seemed to be a pretty good addition.
Yeah, I know people are disappointed they let Jacoby Myers go. And for good reason. It's nice when a player works really hard to become a contributor, and know, they brought him in as an undrafted free agent the year they took N'Keal Harry in the first round, and didn't take Meyer a long time to blow past him and become the reliable guy and really what Harry was supposed to be. So a lot of admiration for him, but he's not a yards after the catch guy. He's not really that efficient. He was last season, but there have been a lot of seasons where he's targeted a lot but didn't have a lot of receptions, and I'm sure those are considerations for why they really didn't try to keep him. Smith Schuster's really good after the catch. We'll see how he fits in the Patriots culture that Belichick likes to have, because he's been kind of a goofball in the Chad Ochocinco sort of way with the Steelers and last year with the Chiefs. But he's a talented player still. And if they go and get another receiver, I'd really like to see them make a trade for Jerry Jeudy if they could get the Broncos to take a second round pick and you know, maybe a player or another pick, which sounds like the asking price. He's a guy who gets open. He has a little bit of history with Mac, though. Mac wasn't the starter when Jeudy was in his last year at Alabama, but they know each other well. And, of course, the Bill O'Brien tie, too. I think that would be a really good guy for them to bring in and just kind of complete this receiving core and make guys for once fit into the ideal roles, which just wasn't the case last year.
What are you hearing about what sounds like pending layoffs at ESPN?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I've been a little bit out of the media loop, but that's always a bummer, disappointing when that happens, because they've gone through it drastically a few times, and it's always some familiar names, and you tend to forget about the people behind the scenes that are also deeply affected by this that, don't have the public name to fall back on. So it's always disappointing, and it always makes you a little bit cynical, too, because No, Disney's had problems, but ESPN can really afford pretty much whatever they want to do. You just look at the rights fees they pay for live events. It's disappointing to see their cuts come from personnel.
And did I see that you talked to Jim Nance recently about the end of his run doing the NCAA basketball tourney?
Yeah, that was my Sunday media column. He did a conference call with us media types and just before the start of the tournament, and he was really emotional. I can't recall. Do you remember him getting emotional on the air before about anything? The
math? No, I don't.
Something like that. Yeah, I don't either. And but he gets choked up a couple of times talking about how much Fred Couples, his college roommate and golf teammate at the University of Houston, he said him winning the 92 Masters is the coolest thing he's ever covered, and it means the most to him. And I figured it was the Tiger thing one way or the other, 97 maybe, but that's not it. And he said if the University of Houston wins the Final Four, and they got a chance in Houston, the Final Four being in Houston, that would be number two on his list. So my takeaway is he doesn't rate the Patriots' big victories that he called as highly as he should.
But boy, he's been the consummate pro, and he's I think the this generation's guy. It was Kurt Gowdy, it was Brent Musburger for a while, but that guy, when you hear their voice, you just know it's a major event.
Yeah, you know what it made me think of? I was at UMaine when he got the gig, and it was 91, I think, and it was shocking that they let Brent Musburger go as the voice of the NCAA tournament. He was the number one guy then, and right before one of those UNLV Duke games, I think in 91, word broke that Musburger was being fired, and he talked about it like before the championship game broadcast, and it was stunning. And it's funny, they moved Nance into that role, but they actually they considered Sean McDonough, who's still in Boston at that point. They considered Bob LaBelle, who was the Channel 4 sportscaster forever, but it was Nance that eventually slid into that role. And he ended up with one of the great resumes, LinkedIn pages, I guess, of any broadcaster of pretty much any generation.
And as far as the Red Sox teams go, have they given any more specifics about the number of games broadcasters are likely to work?
Yeah, but I can't remember them right now. I know I know Joe is doing most of the home games, I think 75, and on the radio, and he, Merlone told me he's Joe's going to do the cities that he likes on the road.
Good for him.
Cleveland, Tampa, Baltimore for sure. But other than that, I'm not sure. Lou's got like 40 games on TV and 40 something on radio, so he's kind of splitting the job. Euclid is going to do the most as a color analyst on TV, but the guy I'm watching is Will Middlebrooks. He's a really gregarious, likable, friendly guy, and I think once he gets the hang of it in the booth, he's going to be really good as an analyst.
And who's likely to succeed Mike Gorman on the Celtics games?
That's a good question, because Grandy's done a really good job. Mm. He's been here 20 years. I mean, he's even more than that. I think he got here in 2001 after being the Timberwolves TV voice. He wants it, and he makes that pretty clear, but I don't think it's a certainty. I know NBC Sports Boston has kind of put feelers out, or at least discussed among themselves some other possibilities. I really liked Ian Eagle's son, Noah, who does Clippers games. He did the Nickelodeon football games, but I think his profile might be getting too big now to come to a specific market. But I think Grandy would be a great fit. I don't know what they would do on the radio when he moves over, because they use John Wallach right now, and he's not a Grandy-level broadcaster. But, we'll see. There's no certainty, no sure thing after Mike steps down next season.
Chad Finn of the Boston Globe with us here on Downtown. Chad, thank you much. Good luck in the final leg of your marathon media tour today.
The final leg is always the hardest.
Well, it's who you're dealing with. But from here, from here in the center of the sandwich, great to have you with us as always, and we'll check in again soon.
Yeah, I'll talk to you soon, Lunch Meat.
It's the best nickname I've ever had. Thank you, Chad.